not only has been preserved against the ravages of the Cultural Revolution, but also technologically has proved to be more successful and has been carried out more rapidly than the nuclear program of France. Our next speaker, ladies and gentlemen, is Professor Milorad Rašković, who comes to us from Belgrade, Yugoslavia. He used to be a Chetnik in World War II, so he knows a great deal of first-hand knowledge of guerrilla warfare. And if I may add, Professor Rašković is the son of a cabinet minister of Yugoslavia. Back in 1921, before he himself was born, was assassinated by the communists. So his knowledge is not a bookish knowledge. His knowledge is a very profound personal experience. He is a PhD from the University of Geneva, and he's presently the senior associate of the Hoover Institution for War, Revolution, and Peace. He has published a number of books, including one I happen to cherish in French about problems of war and socialism. But he also has been the editor of several multi-volume works resulting from various conferences which he suggested and organized at the Hoover Institution, including a symposium on 100 years of revolutionary internationalism and a symposium on the Comintern. He himself is the director of the Hoover Institution's program on the history of the Third International. I particularly commend to your attention the first volume of the Yearbook on International Communist Affairs, again a series of publications which Professor Rašković suggested and which great deal of travail he started. First volume is out. It covers all the activities of all the communist parties in all the world in the year of 1966. This is a gigantic piece of work which he did. It is a basic reference book which is of use to all of us. And I don't hesitate to put in this commercial, not only because you should know our speaker a little better, but also because I think I'm doing you a service by calling your attention to this particular publication. Professor Rašković.
Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, it is decisively not a cheerful morning, and I have to contribute my grain of salt in this breast beating about our overall situation in the world, and I have to add into this country itself. The title of the few remarks I would like to make this morning is The New Left and the War in Vietnam. Because I think here we are dealing, the two previous speakers have informed us in their extremely competent and objective way, what are the outside dangers for this country. And my rather sad duty is to report to what extent we are facing not simply the threat of Soviet or Chinese brand of communism, but a rather unconventional or unusual internal danger. In order to introduce my subject in the best way I think I could, I would like to quote you a relatively long statement from the so-called Vietnam Day Committee that was established at the University of California at Berkeley 2 years ago. And at the same time to indicate this little booklet, which might be known to some of you, called We Accuse. It Until the series of speech is made at Berkeley 2 years ago by a certain number of very prominent American, and not only American, intellectuals, and it is probably one of the harshest indictments of the entire US society one can imagine. I hope that this accused will not remain in history in the same level as Zola's J'accuse, but in any case, it is an important document about our time. And here is what the leaders of the Vietnam Day Committee, who could be probably called the best representatives or the most typical representatives of the new left, had to say. I quote, "Vietnam, like Mississippi, is not an aberration. It is a mirror of America. Vietnam is American foreign policy. It is only that in Peru, Bolivia, and South Africa, the revolutionary movement has not yet progressed to the point where napalm and marines are necessary. Vietnam reduces to absurdity the fifth grade civics class rhetoric about American democracy and American morality, and lays bare the reality. A white nation bombing a colored people, a Christian country bombing a non-Christian country, a rich, highly developed nation laying waste the resources of an underdeveloped land. Vietnam lays bare the violence beneath the smiles and informality of American life. It gives us every reason to look at ourselves, at our neighbors, and say, we are accomplices in murder. Vietnam is the Guernica, the Rotterdam, and the Lidice of the 1960s. Johnson, to most of the world, recalls Hitler, invoking national honor and anti-communism to rationalize mass murder. We, the American people, the lawyer, the truck driver, the engineers, and the secretaries, are the people whose guilt will be the subject of philosophy tracts on responsibility to be written by African philosophers in the year 2000. Can we say we didn't know? We know, and this knowledge defines our lives for us. We must go into the suburbs, small towns and ghettos of this country to talk with the American people about Vietnam. We must force people to commit themselves. Where there is no talk, we must induce debate. Where there is debate, we must induce protest. At the risk of being called traitors to our country, we must question injustice and accuse those who are responsible. We must make connections. The Los Angeles riots of the summer of 1965 are analogous to the peasant struggle in Vietnam. The free speech movement in Berkeley is analogous to both Los Angeles and Vietnam. Peasants throughout the world ghettoize Negroes and other poor people in America, and middle-class American youth are all part of the same movement. Liberalism cannot solve our problems. Only direct, collective political action by the oppressed themselves can." Unquote. I'm sorry it is a long statement, but I think it is a very significant one, and if I may, I would like to make three basic comments, which I think are very relevant to the point. Number one, as you may see from this statement, and it was written 2 years ago, I think that the escalation of at least verbal protest has been increased since 1965 when this text was written. Number one, my first comment is that here we deal with a global indictment of the United States where the problem of Vietnam is only incidental. In other words, Vietnam is, if you want, the end result, an eruption of a longer process of self-induced intellectual, moral, and political incubation. This anger, this belief that the American society as it is established is beyond redemption, and that in the final analysis, the society which can commit such crimes around the world is a society that morally, intellectually, legally, if you want, merits only a sort of the violent destruction. In this sense, particularly because as an intellectual, I speak to the intellectuals, I think that it is relevant just for a second to see how this process came, how this extraordinary degree of alienation among the people who belong to the most affluent academic generation in American history, how it came about. And here I would like, very briefly, I will certainly not tell you anything you do not know, but I think that this systematic approach is helpful. I was struck when I came, since I came in this country in 1958, and up to now, to what extent a certain number, a relatively small group of prominent, very articulate writers, have practically been molding the minds and the souls of many of our younger people at the universities. Let me just mention three names here, three names who I think are the most prominent one. The first one is the late sociologist at Columbia University, C. Wright Mills. C. Wright Mills died, as you know, in 1961, but he is probably the most important sociologist in this country, which has created, if you want, these very basic feelings that the entire basis of the American society and the civilization is nothing but the emanation of this guilty money cult, which is identified in his views with our corporate society. It is interesting that Saul Landau, who was his personal secretary, he said in one article in the Rumperts magazine, where else but Rumperts magazine, that though Wright Mills practically never mentioned Marx, he has actually denounced the American capitalist system in a more effective way than all of the Marxist theoreticians taken together. And incidentally, if you take the books, which I think but probably tens, if not hundreds of thousands of the paperbacks have covered this country, the White Collar, the Power Elite, particularly the Power Elite, Listen Yankee, his explanation of the Cuban Revolution, the Sociological Imagination, the Causes of the Third World War, another important of his books, finally, his latest paperback, The Marxist, and so on. Here you have the man who, with a high degree of sophistication or pseudo-sophistication as you like, the man who was never the member of the American Communist Party, who was not even identified with many of the front groups, he is the man who just succeeded, if you want, to inculcate with a good number of young American intellectuals, that this society is a morally basically wicked society and that this society is not worthy saving. Then the next man I would like to mention very briefly is Paul Goodman. Paul Goodman, who this sort of the anarchist, neo-anarchist vision, which is very much popular at many of the campuses. He was a resident professor at the University, San Francisco State College a couple of years ago. And here again, I think Goodman, in a certain sense, contributes or builds, if I may say so, on the basis of Wright Mills' destruction. Here is his vision of this totally liberated society in which the individual doesn't have any responsibility to anybody else but to the whims, if you want, of his own impulses. And then the last man, the most difficult one, but if you study a little what is the reading curriculum of some of the leaders of the New Left, you might say that perhaps on the highest level of sophistication, or once again of pseudo-sophistication, is perhaps the most influential intellectual, Professor Herbert Marcuse, presently at San Diego, Professor of Philosophy, University of California at San Diego, whose book, published in 1964, One Dimensional Man, is probably the most influential book in building this infrastructure, if I may so say so, of intellectual alienation among our new leftists. That is an extremely interesting book. I would like just to quote you one sentence, which is so characteristic for his what could be this curious combination of the neo-Marxist revolutionary projection. I quote from his book, "The specter is there again." Which specter? Obviously, the specter 1848, Communist Manifesto. "The specter is there again. The historical extremes may meet again. The most advanced consciousness of humanity and its most exploited forces," which is a very typical Marxian sentence and which is so, I think, characteristic for many of these young idealistic intellectuals, this combination. The most advanced consciousness of humanity, the people who fight on the front of the progress, and who at the same time are the people who build the revolutionary consciousness of these most exploited forces. It is interesting, however, in which way Herbert Marcuse has revised Marx. For him, the working class, particularly the industrial working class, has actually become a conservative element in the existing society. Who are then these really revolutionary people? on the one hand, the elite of the alienated elite, and then, I quote again Marcuse, underneath the conservative popular base, the conservative popular base is the substratum of the outcast and outsiders, the exploited and persecuted of other races and other colors, the unemployed and the unemployable. Their opposition is revolutionary even if their consciousness is not. The fact that they start refusing to play the game may be the fact which marked the beginning of the end of the period, unquote. Here is, I think, captured, if you want, this essential vision of the new leftist, of those youngsters who essentially belong to the middle, very often of the upper classes, who are alienated against their own milieu, and who see themselves, if you want, in this Marcusean vision, there are the people who will lead these masses of the the outcast and outsiders to the barricades of final liberation. So I think that so much about the intellectual role of some of the writers. Then the second element, which explains much of this forthcoming wave of new leftist militantism, is what I would call the myth of civil disobedience, which started in 1960s in the South, but which, characteristically enough, transformed itself from a typically Southern phenomenon into a global one. Mario Savio, the name is certainly familiar to all of you, the fiery leader of the free speech movement, who at present moment is running for a Congress in California, in the Peace and Freedom Party. Well, Mario Savio explained that he went to the South to fight against the racial segregation there. And then he said, then when I came back to California, I discovered that the problem was not the problem of the South, that the problem is the same everywhere, and that everywhere we are facing the same establishment, the same injustice, the same necessity of engagement and final overthrow of the wicked regime. And finally, in the same syndrome of this new wave of the new left is certainly the role of the Castro's revolution. While for the new left, the Soviet Union represents a rather quasi-Victorian, rather boring society in which it is difficult to identify oneself, there is a bearded mystical hero, there is a little David of the Caribbeans who is on the one hand challenging the wicked corporate giant of the United States, and on the other hand, who in his unorthodox way is really submitting the entire Cuban society to the new brand of social engineering. And then, if you want, Vietnam came in a certain sense to be only a catalyst. The Vietnam was not something what provoked the wave of the new left. Vietnam came, if you want, as a very convenient pretext to enhance their own militancy. And it is even interesting that these days, perhaps in the last several months, since the death of Che Guevara in Bolivia, it is even the Che Guevara is a real patron saint of the new left in this country. Now let me end this first remark with a paradox, which is, as you probably know, the very prominent American sociologist, Professor Daniel Bell from Columbia University, in 1960 published his interesting book, The End of Ideology. The end of ideology, and in a certain sense, Professor Bell was right if you look at the complex American society at large. But it was, if you want, a sort of the great irony that just at the same time when Professor Bell was telling us that the ideology was withering away from the American society, it was just the time when this new ideological wave, this specifically new ideological wave of the new left was rising, what indicates once again how often dangerous it is for the intellectual to be the prophets of their own time. Now, this new ideology, which will lead me to my second point, was developed with a certain number of clarity by a man also who teaches present in San Francisco State College, Paul Jacobs. Paul Jacobs, who is running for the Senate of California on the Peace and Freedom Party. I watched him the other night on educational television, Channel 9 in San Francisco, where he explained, discussing the Vietnam situation, when he explained Vietnam has contributed in something to develop something new in this country. And that is, as he said, our identification with the enemy. I think that this extraordinary complex identification of the enemy, or if you want, the transfer of your patriotic loyalty, that you identify yourself not with your country, even in the largest sense of the word, but you identify yourself with the opponent against whom the formal forces of your own nation are fighting. That leads me to my second point, which is so typical from this text and which could be developed in countless variations. That is this insistence on the American guilt. This extraordinary approach, which is not, let's say, as our colleague from the Hoover Institution, Theodore Draper, with whom Professor Posani and I not necessarily agree, but, or even the Senator McCarthy, which is the approach that the war in Vietnam is a mistaken war, that we shouldn't have entered, that we shouldn't wage the war as we do. That is a rational approach where we can agree or disagree. But what I'm speaking is, concerning the war in Vietnam, is this different approach, which is that America is of necessity guilty. Mary McCarthy, for example, in his in her famous or unfamous book, depends from your viewpoint, said exactly, we are not simply to discuss politically what Vietnam means. We have to get out of Vietnam. So here is this very curious, what could we call this selective morality, the morality which is of necessity always. Everything what the Americans are doing is wrong. Everything what the other side is doing can at least be analytically approached. Here exists what I really do not have any other words but to call the sort of the masochistic element of anti-Americanism. When you read, you might have seen some of you, the latest book published by Simon & Schuster about on the war in Vietnam. Perhaps some 200 intellectuals of the Western world, pro and con, unfortunately, 4-1 probably against our involvement over there. You see this curious moralistic or quasi-moralistic aspect where you do not have the discussion of what are the implications of the war, but where you have this moralistic furor that the United States are by definition wrong. Miss Susan Sontag, whose pretty face you can see, and I'm saying that in the full sense of the word, she's a pretty young lady, space you can see very, very often at New York television and even sometime nationwide, she wrote in an extraordinary essay that she is for the first time ashamed of being a citizen of this criminal country. And in another article recently in the Partisan Review, she said this, I quote her, white race is a cancer of society, unquote. Now, what cancerous influence Ms. Sontag may exercise on her students at Columbia University is beyond this discussion. At the same time, recently, for example, I had the opportunity to, well, it should have been the debate, unfortunately it wasn't, that I was recently at the University of Oregon to debate with Dr. Benjamin Spock. Unfortunately, he didn't vote the debate. But listening to him, I was literally flabbergasted once again that this man, who is probably a very nice gentleman, would be a good neighbor in a non-political realm, which sort of discourse he made to the students. He got a standing ovation, the people like the people who are under indictment. But what was incredible to me was, for example, how he wanted to justify, somebody asked him, but what? You who indict so much the United States, what about the Chinese attitude? What about this conditioning of the entire nation in the anti-American sense? And then the good baby doctor had this wonderful comment when he said, well, Mao Zedong is justified to build the anti-American atmosphere in China because after all what we did to them, they are at least justified to answer in the same form. So here, actually, we do not deal with any rational category. And to tell you frankly, the relative newcomer in this country, it is simply beyond my intellectual grasp. What motivates all those people to bite the American hand that feeds them. But that leads me to my last point, and the most dangerous point. This intellectual elucubration, the final analysis, well, we speak among ourselves, we know that sometimes the producing of the hot air will not influence the world events. But we have to pass now into something what is much more important than this declamation of individual or collective guilt, where incidentally Freud is perhaps very often better interpreter than Marx concerning their behavior. The third point deals with one sentence from the manifesto I just read to you, speaking with the direct collective political action. In this text, it doesn't mean much, but we are not in 1965, we are tomorrow entering the month of April 1968, and you will see why month of April 1968 can be of quite an importance for us. Two, as you know, two organizations are the most representative for the new left today in the United States. The Students for a Democratic Society, overwhelmingly white, middle-class, upper-class organization of alienated youth, and the Students Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, today exclusively Negro organization. With the SDS, whose development I have tried to follow relatively carefully, the very interesting feature is what I would call, and could very easily, I think, document, in a literal sense of the word, galloping to the militant revolutionary left. Let me just read you one sentence, and it was even before all the terrible events of last year, New York, Detroit, and so on, which Tom Hayden, one of the founders of the SDS, wrote in the Partisan Review, Winter 1966 issue. I quote Tom Hayden. Perhaps the only forms of action appropriate to the angry people are violent. Perhaps a small minority, by setting ablaze New York and Washington, could damage this country forever in the court of world public opinion, unquote. That was before Detroit last summer. But then, in this extraordinary phenomenon of self-induce, a realization that the American society is beyond redemption, and that only a revolutionary approach should be used, we have, for example, the official proclamation of the SDS that the days, the 10 days between April 21st and April 30th of the next month, should be, I quote, 10 days to shake the empire. 10 days to shake the empire, and needless to know, for all of you here, it is rather the lack of imagination or the intentional repetition, quasi-repetition of the famous book of the earliest American Bolshevik, John Reed, 10 Days That Shook the World. What is so interesting it is with these people who are preparing for the revolution that they say in their publication this. This time, of course, we will not be able to see the power. We still are not strong enough to destroy the American wicked giant, but it will be the American 1905. It will be the American first revolution, which then, of course, one day will lead to the full-fledged revolution. What this playing with the fire by the people who very often do not realize, as George Orwell said, that the fire is hot, what it will mean, we will see in a few weeks. But there is something else, and something no less ominous. It is the evolution of the SNCC. Up to July 1966, the Students Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, under the leadership of a young Negro student, John Lewis, was one of the militant but really essentially nonviolent organizations that fought what they believed on the front of the progress. And then it was taken in the June 1966 by Stokely Carmichael, and since that time we have had these young people engaging in the most violent preparation for action one can imagine. The time is short. If somebody is interested, I have here the Stokely Carmichael interview with the Algerian publication, La Révolution Africaine, in which he openly admits how they infiltrated the SNCC. He said, we were never non-violent, but we enter into this non-violent organization in order to prepare the revolutionary cadres. And then he was very candidly explaining which ways of the destruction of America have to be taken, which sort of action, urban guerrilla warfare, the destruction of the American economic potential through the destruction of American factories, and so on and so on. And since that time, something what I find, at least potentially very ominous, is that Stokely, who is not a fool, the Rev. Brown and many of the others, are trying to condition their followers, not simply that they should pass into the revolutionary action, but that the white community is ready and itching for a genocidal assault against the black community, and that in this sense, the blacks have to be ready to answer to this potential violence, white violence, with their readiness for combat. I will give you just two, I think, very interesting illustrations from San Francisco Express Times, with this very square title, this underground paper, volume 1, number 6, February 29th, 1968, a letter from Rep. Brown, in which says, for example, for every Max Stanford and Huey Newton — Huey Newton, incidentally, is one of the Negro leaders in California who is jailed now and accused for assassinating a white policeman — for all those people, there must be 10 dead racist cops. And for every black death, there must be Dien Bien Phu. May the death of 1968 signal the beginning of the end of this country. I do what I must out of the love for my people. My will is to fight. Resistance is not enough. Aggression is the order of the day. And then he makes a general appeal. We have to organize mankind to rejoice in your American destruction and ruin. Another of the leading advocates of the same organization, James Forman, the international director of the Students' Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, was presently asking fellow revolutionaries to fulfill the following in the event of his assassination. I quote, 10 war factories destroyed, 15 police stations blown up, 30 power plants demolished, no flowers, one southern governor, two mayors, and 500 racist white cops dead. A generous sustaining contribution to SNCC. Formally, is also quoted as demanding, in the event of the assassination of Stokely Carmichael or H. Rep. Brown, that the above figures be doubled. Well, I'm coming now to my conclusion and to the very three brief final remarks. Nobody's prophet, and I'm the last one to say what will happen next month. Let's pray for the best. But in any case, already now, I think that we are in the presence of an immense social tragedy in this country. Immense social tragedy in this sense that, on the hand, we have the innocence of the young idealists who simply do not know the score and who rather foolishly follow, perhaps, very generous impulses of their young nature in following the operation which, in the final analysis, can only harm them and their country. Immense social tragedy also because we see around us what I would call very non-academically the dirty work of professionals who know very well what is the score and who know for which reasons they want to destroy this country. My second remark is it is in the fullest sense of the word the crisis of the liberal civilization. This time L is an uppercase. And here is something, a paradox, of which we so-called conservatives could rather cynically enjoy, rejoice in. For the new young radicals, one of their slogans is, the enemy is the liberal. And in this sense, as I said rather maliciously, we could rejoice in this spectacle of the liberals being attacked on their own left, being attacked by the very people whom directly or indirectly they created in their acid criticism of the basis of Western civilization. But in a way, I really don't think that anyone, so-called conservatives, should have any reason to rejoice in that spectacle. Finally, to me, ladies and gentlemen, I think that what you are witnessing today on the higher intellectual level is a new manifestation of what Julien Benda already wrote in 1930s, La Trahison des Clercs, the betrayal of the intellectuals. And here is the problem where a society like the Philadelphia Society perhaps should try to give a certain answer. The key question for us is the question which Lenin opened at this century, 1902, when he wrote his famous, "What is to be done?" It appears that the people who want to destroy our society have their answers how to do it. The problem is how we will be able to answer that challenge. Thank you very much.